The information and opinions presented in this ARC Energy Ideas podcast are provided for informational purposes only and are subject to the disclaimer link in the show notes.
This is the ARC Energy Ideas podcast with Peter Terzakian and Jackie Forrest, exploring trends that influence the energy business.
Welcome to the ARC Energy Ideas podcast. I'm Jackie Forrest.
And I'm Peter Terzakian. Welcome back. Well, Jackie, it's been, it's been a couple of weeks since COP26 is over, and we've had a chance to listen to some of the reactions from various parties. What are people saying?
Well, I mean, some are disappointed because they wanted that big deal like we did with the Paris Agreement where everyone agrees to 1.5 degrees C, and that didn't happen. But at the same time, I think there were some real wins on smaller things and bilateral agreements.
Yeah. Candidly, it would be a miracle if representatives of 8 billion people or how many people there are in the world agreed to absolutely everything. It would be a miracle. But there was a number of things that came out of COP26. We talked about it in our last podcast. For example, the Glasgow Financial Alliance announcements, the methane regulations, the deforestation, so on and so forth. But what's the overall tone, though? I mean, it's sort of been pitched as a little bit of a failure, given that not everybody agreed to everything and all that talk at the end about coal semantics.
Yeah, I mean, I think that was some disappointment around the resolution on coal. But, you know, I think there were a lot of positives as climate markets and, you know, the ability to maybe trade carbon credits outside of your borders, I think is a big deal. I'd like to have a future podcast on that because it's a big topic.
Well, yeah, I think it's essential to have a podcast on carbon credits because behind the scenes, that whole scene is going berserk, if I can say it. Like, there's just so much action and activity and a disorderly carbon market in the face of some of the market forces that are potentially coming to play will, in my opinion, actually serve as points of resistance to getting to net zero by 2050. So, you know, this whole thing, further to our last podcast, really is predicated upon trying to create a little bit more order out of the disorder. And on that note, we have a special guest who is highly qualified to talk about things related to climate change and perspectives from COP and so on and so forth. So we are delighted to have with us Andrew Weaver, who is a leading climate scientist, currently a professor at the University of Victoria. He was elected as an MLA in BC, firstly in 2013. He was the first Green Party MLA in the province, but by 2017, he led the Green Party in BC to win 3 seats and negotiated a power-sharing agreement with the NDP, which we all remember. So, an expert in climate change, an expert in the politics of climate change, I think we are going to have a very great discussion here. Welcome, Andrew Weaver.
Oh, thank you for having me on your show.
Great. Well, we're really excited to hear from you, Andrew. Now, you started your career as a climate scientist. Why did you decide to become a politician and eventually leader of the Green Party?
Well, I got my PhD in the 1980s, and I've been working in this field since the 1980s. You can go back to 1979, in fact. That's the year I graduated from high school. And it's also the year, the first year, there was a national assessment coming out of the U.S. in terms of trying to put together the collective understanding of what we know about climate science. And in that year, it was put out by Jules Charney and others. They made an estimate of what climate sensitivity was. Now, climate sensitivity, by definition, is how much would the world warm if it doubles atmospheric carbon dioxide levels from pre-industrial, which are 280 parts per million, to 560. The best estimate in 1979 of climate sensitivity was 1.5 to 4.5 degrees of warming. That was 1979. I was a lead author in the second, the third, the fourth, and the fifth IPCC assessments. By the time the fifth IPCC assessment came around in 2013, the best estimate of climate sensitivity, the single most important metric summarizing our collective understanding of the climate problem, was 1.5 to 4.5 degrees. It hadn't changed since the Charney's estimate in 1979. Literally tens of thousands of papers had been published. We know more and more and are more and more certain about this problem. We're more and more certain about what our uncertainties are. And we know what needs to be done, but nothing's getting done. So as somebody who had worked very closely with the Gordon Campbell government at the introduction of climate policy in BC back earlier this century, and also working with other federal leaders, I felt I couldn't stand by and watch Christy Clark at the time come in and start to dismantle the leadership BC had, trying to sell this, what I would call a bill of goods, that somehow we were all going to get prosperity from liquefied natural gas. It was all nonsense. But I felt I couldn't stand by on the sidelines, having spent my entire life working in climate science, to see the little work we'd done in BC being dismantled. So I ran as a point of principle. I got elected. And I realized that you can actually facilitate change. And so I ran a second time, and we were able to get a climate plan back in BC. And I've always believed that we should have term limits for politicians, because once you're there for a long time, you know, you can develop a sense of entitlement. And so after two terms, I decided that was it. And here I am.
Actually, can I ask you about that range, 1.5 to 4.5? Because the way climate change is often positioned in the media and others is that it's sort of like it's a point estimates, right? But we know that there's big error bars. The 1.5 to 4.5 sort of speaks to that range. So based on all your experience since the first paper you wrote, we are now pushing about 450 parts per million, somewhere in there. Is that range still as wide as that? And is it going toward the high end of the range or the low end of the range? What are you seeing?
That's actually a great question, because for the first time, the last IPCC assessment, you know, the sixth, the one that was released this past summer, that range was tightened to 2.5 to 4 degrees. So it's looking like it's the central estimate, which was 3 degrees put forward in 1979, has remained to be the best central estimate now. So there's more uncertainty in the error bars on the high end of the climate sensitivity than there is on the lower end. There's lots of ways of constraining climate sensitivity now that didn't exist historically. In particular, we've got paleoclimatic records and instrumental records. We've got multiple models. So it is tightening up to 2.5 to 4 degrees now, with 3 as the best central estimate.
And is that 2.5 to 4 based on the 560 number, the doubling from 280?
280 to 560. That's historically what it was done from. It's historically, it came from that, yeah.
Yeah, and the 560 is probably, if we keep on our current path trajectory of business as usual, I'll call it, of carbon emissions, that's where the 2050, 2060 sort of comes in, right?
And it takes a while to equilibrate to the higher level of warming, of course, because we have to heat the oceans, and that takes time. Nevertheless, we're on track for easily 1.5, 2 degrees this century. Probably a lot more than that if we don't start mitigating our emissions sooner than later.
Well, let's talk a little bit about climate. I mean, you're back at University of Victoria. I'm assuming you're working on climate issues again. Okay.
Policy side now, because working as a climate scientist since the 1980s, I can tell you, it's really tough to want to start publishing more papers saying, well, you know what, we know more and more about this problem, and yes, it's really bad, and I can tell you even more about how bad it is, as opposed to let's deal with the problem. So I'm much more focused on solutions now than I am on the pure science of the climate.
Okay, on the policy. Right now, we're witnessing here on the news every day what's going on with BC with these flooding. It looks just terrible in some areas of BC, and we really feel for the tragedy of the people that are caught up in that. And of course, we saw all these extreme high temperatures and fires and smoke in BC this summer. How does your work inform us on how climate change contributes to these events? Or if you're not doing that work anymore, but the work that's out there, I mean, you talked about the IPCC sixth study. It talked a lot about attribution of climate to some of these events.
So I've done a lot of work in the area of what's called climate change detection and attribution over the years. The notion here is, how do you say whether or not an event, a particular weather event, would or would not have occurred in the absence of global warming? And so there are means and ways of assessing the likelihood of an occurrence of a particular event in the absence of global warming. And as you'll know, it's that it is impossible to ever attribute a one-to-one correspondence between anything that happens in the weather and any other climate driver, because of the fact that you can't attribute weather and climate together, because climate, by definition, is the statistics of weather, the likelihood of occurrence of a particular weather event. Weather is that weather event. So, you know, the way we do it in the climate community is we take a look at the magnitude of a particular event, and then we go to our models, which are similar to numerical weather prediction models, and we run multiple ensembles exploring the likelihood of a particular anomaly of that size in our numerical weather prediction type models. And in two different forms, one without the additional greenhouse gases in the atmosphere and the other is with. What you can do is you find that these extreme events are far more prevalent in a warmer world than they are in a less warmer world. And you are then able to detect exactly how much more likely it is because of the fact that global warming is there. So there are very sophisticated ways of saying this. But back of the envelope, what we had in Lytton this past summer, where we literally shattered Canadian temperature record at anywhere it doesn't take a rocket scientist to figure out that that is extraordinarily unusual and would be virtually impossible were it not for the additional loading of greenhouse gas in the atmosphere. The same with our floods. I mean, Victoria was cut off. Most of BC was cut off. Every highway into Vancouver was cut off by landslides. These weather events are so outside of anything that is normal, it is relatively straightforward to formally detect and attribute those to global warming. Just like we did in 2004, I did some work with Mike Flanagan at University of Alberta, Forest Guy, Nathan Gillett and Francis Weirs. We were able to suggest that the increasing area burnt on forest fires was also detectable and attributable in Canada to increasing greenhouse gases. And that's because we know what the predictors of that are. So there's a lot of work done. And what we can say is many of the events we're seeing now are attributable to human activity.
Yeah, you're sort of pointing out the differences between climatology and meteorology, which are two different things. And yeah, actually, there's a really interesting article, I just read it in Scientific American, about sort of these things like the atmospheric rivers and the flooding type of things that are coming out. And you know, you look at the data, it's pretty compelling that the frequency of these things is increasing. And so translating that into Canada, we've seen a disproportionate amount recently of weather volatility in the West, BC. Can you give our audience a sense of how your modeling is informing what Canada as a whole can expect?
So there's the main center for Canadian climate projections is the Canadian Center for Climate Modeling and Analysis at the University of Victoria. It's a federal government lab. It's located on our campus. I'm actually not a federal government employee. I'm a university employee. We work very closely with the federal government, trying to explore some of the sensitivities in their models. But the federal government, of course, are the ones who are developing the products necessary to inform decisions in Canada. And it is for quite some time, we in the climate community have been saying that what we should expect is increasing extremes in precipitation, increasing extremes in temperature, and on and on and on. Exactly what we're seeing. And we've been saying that for decades. Unfortunately, many people have simply not paid heed to that, and we continue on our merry ways. And then what happens, of course, is that suddenly a big storm comes, and everyone moves directly from not worrying about climate change to sheer hysteria and panic is that we have to solve it overnight. And the reality of this is it doesn't work that way. It's just a very slow, systemic problem that we have to get a handle on, but it requires thoughtful policy and not hysterical, reactionary policy.
Yeah, I think that this is key. And, you know, increasingly, there just seems to be a lot of hysteria. And if I can quote you from a recent newspaper article, a really great quote. You said, it's scientifically dishonest to argue for something that is not attainable, referring to the physical realities of transitioning our energy systems overnight. And you go on to say that your concern is that there's a generation of youth who will become despondent, lose hope, and these are the leaders of tomorrow. And that if we continue on this path of hysteria and not just sort of basically calm down and think about policy holistically so that we can have an orderly transition that is optimized, then we're going to be in real trouble. Is that really what you're sort of referring to?
Exactly. That's exactly correct. And I have been working in this field for quite some time. I've been teaching youth for decades. I've been going into schools for decades. I've been speaking about climate change in public fora across the world, frankly. And time and time again, many, many youths, there's a sense of despondency and a sense of hopelessness. Mental illness is a very real issue, climate fatigue, climate grief, it's very real. And then when I see things like the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change report with respect to 1.5 degrees, suggesting that somehow we can keep warming to 1.5 degrees, and then I see international policymakers talking about it, and I see everyone shouting at the clouds that we need to do this, and I know it's just not possible. I mean, there is a real problem here when we know the world has warmed between 1.1 and 1.2 degrees already. We've already warmed by that amount. We know that the permafrost carbon feedback is going to give us another 0.1, 0.2 degrees. We know that if we do no more than just keep existing greenhouse gas levels fixed at today's values, we'll warm by about another 0.6. So we know we're at about 1.8, 1.9 degrees, regardless of the policy measures we do today. And we know that we're not going to tear down our infrastructure tomorrow. So in my view, it is scientifically dishonest to try to set everyone up for this notion that we're going to keep warming to 1.5 degrees and that we have 8 years left. And the reason why this really troubles me is the 8 years left can send a signal and a message to people that there's hopelessness if we don't solve this in 8 years. But there's nothing magic about 1.5 degrees. Why 1.5? Why not 1.43721? Why not 1.615? There's no scientific decision that came about and said 1.5 is the reality. What happened is that based on small island states and a few other nations arguing in the Paris Accord that they wanted the world to take steps to limit warming to 1.5, the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change member states tasked the scientific community through the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change to produce a report that would show how we could keep warming to 1.5 degrees. And the community did what was asked to do, produce the report. But if you look at that report, the only way to get to 1.5 degrees is to appeal to hypothetical negative emissions on a scale that is unparalleled and using technology that doesn't exist in a couple of years. It's ridiculous to think that we should hang the future of our societies on hypothetical emissions, negative emissions reductions using technologies that doesn't exist, that we have 8 years to actually develop, implement on a scale such that for each one part per million of carbon dioxide we want to remove from the atmosphere, we require 5 gigatons of negative emissions. That's half the global emissions today for one ppm. So not only do we have to eliminate all emissions, we have to get negative emissions on the scale of our positive emissions today. And we have to do all of that in 8 years. It's just so ridiculous that it ends up making us look as a community like we don't know what we're talking about. And I don't know why we continue down this narrative of trying to keep warming by 1.5 degrees, because you just can't.
Yeah, I mean, one great example is, you know, the Paris Agreement happened 6 years ago now, and globally emissions have continued to rise since that time. And then suddenly, you know, in the next 8 years, we're going to drop them all by 50%. It just really seems unrealistic.
It's more than that. Not only drop them, we'll go negative, right? It's crazy.
So what is the solution then, in your opinion? Should we be targeting something more achievable and then thinking about how to adapt to it?
The problem I have always had, and I blame NGOs as much as I blame political leaders who claim that they're very supportive of climate policy, is there has been this fixation on targets. Targets by themselves are utterly meaningless unless they are coupled with pathways to reach those targets. And I will say that in Canada and British Columbia, for the first time since I've been in the field of climate science, and that goes back to the 80s, I felt positive that we finally got in place plans and pathways to reach those targets. So the problem has been that people weren't paying serious attention to this issue. It was really attempts were made to appease the squeaky wheels who were saying we got to deal with climate. Alberta was one of the biggest squeaky wheels because Alberta, of course, has an economy that historically, I would argue not in the present, but historically has revolved around extraction of oil, gas, coal, etc. And that's changing. So there's certainly a squeaky wheel there. And some of the leaders in Alberta were very squeaky. And so governments were appeasing provincial governments. And everyone was just trying to think about how do I get this off my desk? Because it's just an irritant. I want it to go away. It's a problem to go away. And you see that in political spheres all the time. Unfortunately, it won't go away. And finally, I think we're seeing that with both, I can't speak to Alberta, but I can speak to British Columbia and Canada, is we have two leaders who recognize after some time the seriousness of this issue, but also they recognize that dealing with global warming really is incredibly empowering because of the opportunities it creates for prosperity as we essentially transition energy systems from polluting to non-polluting. And that is what Trudeau and Horgan have now recognized. And so we're seeing a transitioning and a positioning to take advantage of these opportunities. So what should be there? I mean, we can talk about, we know any solution to global warming requires global emissions to go to zero. We know that, right? So that we've known for quite some time. We need global emissions to go to zero. So what we need to do then is develop pathways and introduce technologies that are consistent with that trajectory. So it means, for example, we don't build new pipelines because that's not consistent with the trajectory to go to zero. It doesn't mean we shut down the oil sands tomorrow. It means that we don't expand the extraction from the oil sands, right? So it's about transitioning. It's not about immediately panicking. It's about transitioning now, not tomorrow, but now, because the decisions we make today will have a very profound effect on the climate system over the rest of this century. And sadly, our political structures are such that the people making those decisions are typically only around for four-year electoral cycles and hence never have to live the consequences of the decisions they actually made.
So let me expand on some of this, because I think that, for sure, I'm the first to admit massive opportunities exist in this transition, but there's a caveat that the transition has to be orderly and the pathways exist for an orderly. And what I find quite stunning is that the climate community talks about the science, you know, listen to the science, it's all going to be science-based, right? That's the term, it's all going to be science-based. And of course, climatology is all modeling and statistics and statistical science and so on, right? Yet the solutions are a different kind of science. Operations research is a science. Optimization exercises by modeling out how we're going to do this holistically, whether it's dealing with the oil sands or dealing with a buildup in wind and solar or replacing vehicles and so on. In a holistic sense, we have the science, but yet nobody really wants to work holistically is my sense. I mean, I'm not even sure, to be honest with you, the BC and federal governments are really tailoring their efforts to sort of holistic solutions. It's sort of like a whack-a-mole game where you're sort of throwing out policies left, right, and center.
I would say historically, I might have agreed with you, but I truly believe that's not the case now. And I say that in all honesty, having been quite critical of federal and provincial policies over the years, but and supportive of good policies. Let's give some examples. We know, for example, what are the big pieces of the pies in terms of emissions in Canada? Well, we know 25% of our emissions come from the transportation sector. Okay, so that's a low-hanging fruit. What is the policy? We're going to go to no more combustion in the basically transportation sector as we move towards the latter part of this decade. That's a pretty aggressive pathway to zero emissions using technologies that exist. And it essentially means that government just has to, you know, use some knobs and whistles and buttons to send that signal to the market to move to the zero emission transmissions. We also know that 40% of emissions historically in the U.S. were from coal combustion producing electricity. We know that in some places like Alberta, Saskatchewan, it's a very large amount of emissions coming from coal combustion. What's the policy measure? Well, Canada has said by 2030, there will be no more coal combustion in the development of electricity. That's a policy that's not draconian because there are off-the-shelf solutions and frankly, they're cheaper and a win-win. But more than that, Canada says, and not only that, we will no longer ship thermal coal to elsewhere. And not only that, we will no longer allow others, read powder-based and U.S.-based coal, ship through our ports, read Delta Port in Vancouver, to other jurisdictions. So that those two pieces of policy are not going to be the catalyst to cause tens of thousands of jobs to be lost. If anything, they're a catalyst for economic prosperity because we're transitioning. Those policies will get the lion's share of our emissions, just those two simple policies. And then there's all the other things in terms of building codes and on and on and on and procurement in the government. But it is really like you have this old-fashioned switchboard from the, you know, the turn of the early 20th century where you have a phone operator phones in and you see somebody in the switch connecting all these wires and buttons and things. It's very similar with the policy. It's just not one policy. It's like this big board of buttons, knobs, switches, and you get to tinker a little bit with all of them to take us down that path.
Yeah, I'm just not convinced that the tinkering is in any sort of concerted way and that the economy, much like climate, is a very sensitive system. And if you turn a knob too far, like you just sort of get these ripple effects. And I don't have all the answers, but I would conjecture that also your term low-hanging fruit, I would say only realistically in terms of really easy stuff, there's probably only 10 or 15% of total emissions, and then it starts getting quite hard.
I'm going to disagree with you there again. I'm a zero-emission household. Zero emissions. How? Because everything I do is done through electricity, except for the natural gas that I use, which is actually renewable natural gas. I pay a premium for it. So I disagree. I mean, I get in a car. I have two cars. Both are electric. One of my cars has 500 kilometer range. I look in BC now, with the floods, we couldn't get gasoline to the cities. So there were massive gas lineups, but not for electric vehicles. So there's so many co-benefits, and we are so close to the S-curve transition where we're going to basically tipping point to the complete adoption of these. And that's 25% of our emissions. right off the bat. And I could see them being gone largely by the end of this decade. I think that's exciting.
I would agree that there's been major changes in policy in the last 18 months or 2 years in Canada and at some provincial levels as well. I want to come back to, you know, you came out this summer supporting the Liberal election climate plan. You've come out and supported the new Clean BC economic plan that came out a few months ago or a month ago. Now, you had a lot of criticism from the environmental community. What are some of the perspectives of the environmental community that wasn't so happy with your support of these plans?
Well, here's the thing. British Columbia's environmental community is quite diverse and it's quite unique. So when we talk about the environmental community, we're often talking about some of the more radical aspects of the British Columbia environmental community. So I will say, for example, many groups, many of the more mainstream groups, are very pleased with both of them. I look at Clean Energy Canada, for example, extraordinarily pleased with the federal and provincial plans, Pembina, and organizations like that. Where the criticisms have come is, I like to think of it as, when you are there and you're advocating for something and you are afraid, you trigger a fight or flight response. And what do I mean by that? So the issue of climate change mitigation, the issue of dealing with climate, and the language that we're using now about it, like crisis and emergency and catastrophe and all this very loaded language, it sets people up to want immediate solutions and it sets up a fight or flight reaction. So if you are actually despondent or super worried or fearful about this because you've been triggered a fight response, you're going to lash out because you want solutions now. But the irony here is some of the people criticizing me weren't even born when I was talking about climate policy and the importance of dealing with it. And I truly believe that there are some who think that all of a sudden we have to do it now or the world's going to end. And they get anxious about it. And the reality is what we need is thoughtful, a systematic, careful approach, and being truthful and honest about what we're actually doing and why we're doing it. It really does disturb me, some of the political discourse that's out there, because it's not truthful and it's not honest and it's not informing people why we need to do this. Yes, we need to transition. No, we cannot continue to burn fossil fuels. So some of the people who were upset at me were upset because they also believe that the only climate plan that's acceptable is the perfect climate plan. And the problem with perfection is it gets in the way of progress. And that's something that you will only ever realize when you actually are embedded in political decision-making like I was for 8 years, because you recognize that with any piece of policy, there are myriad stakeholders and you can never please everybody. So while you might have the environmental community shouting that they want more, I can tell you, on the other hand, the oil and gas sector in northeastern BC is saying we want less. And then the car dealers are saying, but what about us? And the indigenous communities on the coast are saying you haven't done enough. And then we have the real estate sector saying, well, hang on, what about building code? So there are so many myriad stakeholders that it's really, really difficult to advance the perfect policy right off the bat. And that is why what was done with Clean BC and the federal plan as of December 2020, when Jonathan Wilkinson released a new plan, what was done here is so comprehensive, because it is actually all-encompassing sector-wide, and I'm very excited about it. And that's the first time I have been since I've been in this field since the 1980s.
Hey, by the way, you know, this four Fs, the fright, fight, flight, you know, I've been using that recently too, because what I'm finding as I present to and work with corporate boards and other corporate leaders, and this is outside, by the way, even of the oil and gas industry, just broadly in other emitting industries, there's a lot of fright with the policies that are coming down. And so if we're not careful, the first inclination is to fight. And that's not what we need in terms of an orderly transition. We're just going to lose time, which is not a good thing.
I completely agree with you. And a lot of it is in how you deliver the message, which is why some of this loaded language, you know, crisis, emergency, catastrophe, this language doesn't lead for thoughtful, lend itself well.
Well, it doesn't. And I mean, you know, once you run out of the adjectives, where can you go, right? It's just like there's no more left. Anyway, you mentioned earlier on, and we know from your public statements, you're not supportive of LNG in BC. Why is that, given that LNG Canada and others would suggest that it's among the lowest GHG emitting LNG in the world? Why would we not support that?
Well, first of all, because I don't believe that for one second. It just doesn't make any sense. The story of LNG in BC is a very interesting one. I actually, to this day, don't think we're ever going to actually build LNG Canada. And even if we do export it, we're not going to be exporting BC gas because the BC gas is too deep, too expensive. We'd be exporting conventional gas from Alberta, and there's no requirement to actually have BC gas going out anyway. The bottom line is this, is the reason why LNG was pitched by Christy Clark is that they were 20 to 30 points behind in an election. They needed some message of hope to try to win an election that everyone thought they'd lost. Front page of the Vancouver Province even had a picture of Adrian Dix, our NDP leader at the time, saying this man could kick a dog and he would still win the election. Well, guess what? Christy Clark strategized him, came up with this promise of wealth and prosperity for every single British Columbia through unicorns and Maseratis in our backyard being delivered by LNG. And we're supposed to have had 5 plants operating by now. Well, it was just nonsense because the market didn't support it. It was just wishful thinking. Then she spent, and her government spent 4 years trying to deliver into that. And so to deliver into it, it was like trying to squeeze water from a rock because the economics did not work and they still don't work. So in order to try to get that to happen, out come the giveaways, the infrastructure credits, the deep well royalty credits, which are out of control. It's so weird now in BC that the government actually gives away more royalty credits a year than it collects. So the net royalties to BC are negative right now. So that's how ridiculous it is. Coming back to the notion that it's clean, well, first off, hydraulic fracking is not clean, and there's no way it will be clean or can ever be clean because it involves putting in, as you will know, a mixture of sand and water, which is not potable, and fracturing the shale below the surface, which has issues with respect to stability. It has issues with respect to leakage. That's the most significant thing in terms of methane leakage. And we also know that Canada has historically underreported its fugitive emissions from methane leakage during the hydraulic fracking process significantly. And recently, these numbers in BC have been revised, and guess what? They've been revised up. So we know from an emissions perspective, it is not clear that there is any emissions savings at all in shipping LNG from BC to Korea, even if you displaced coal, because of the fugitive emissions.
I don't want to get into the weeds of all of
this. I'm way in the weeds now.
No, that's okay. And, you know, it'd be great to do that.
Let's call it the eelgrass because it's more relevant.
Yeah. But can I just take this to the higher level of the problem here? And it stems from right at the beginning, in which you're sort of expanding on, you basically don't believe the numbers that the industry is giving. Then the others will give another, I'll call it, source of truth of numbers. And people on the periphery, including potential policymakers, are totally confused. And I've been long arguing that everybody needs to agree on a core set of numbers on this stuff, come together in a civil manner, sit around a table, and agree on what numbers we are going to use. Otherwise, we always get pulled into the weeds, have these arguments, and never agree on anything, and get nothing done. This goes beyond LNG. This goes beyond carbon emission caps, measuring carbon from different industries. Like, what is the source of truth of the numbers? You have those nailed down, more or less, in the whole climate science world. But in the world of the economy, those are not nailed down at all.
And you're right, which is one of the reasons why, from my perspective, even this whole discussion of fugitive emissions and natural gas replacing coal is really misplaced because it's not consistent with the Paris pathway, which means we must transition towards zero emissions. And, you know, switching from coal to natural gas, it's not really a solution to anything because all it's doing is kicking the can down the road. Switching from what has to happen is we have to decarbonize our electricity production, and the decarbonization involves not using natural gas. So it's a lazy person's solution to think that, oh, if we just use natural gas, we're going to solve this. But you're not, because it's still carbon.
Let me challenge you a little bit on that as well, because I think you would agree that burning natural gas is about half the emission intensity of burning coal, for example. So, you know, it's part of a pathway. And people say, well, why are we going to natural gas? It's just a bridge. Let's just go straight to renewables and so on and so forth. And my answer to that is, look, if the house is burning down, why are we spending time thinking about how to renovate the kitchen? Let's just put out the fire. Let's reduce emissions as quickly as possible, because the climate science tells me that if we don't start reducing emissions in the next 10 years, we get kind of like a rebound effect in 2050 or something, right? So like, why do we care what the solution set is as long as we reduce emissions meaningfully?
I agree. But the problem here is we have to be reducing emissions on a pathway that's cost effective. And so what do I mean by that? If you were outfitting infrastructure with something else that is not putting us on the pathway to zero emissions, it's not consistent with Paris. And it means that that will have to be torn down sometime in the near future.
But Paris is theory. Like, this whole notion of the cost curve is going to be dictated by the innovative minds of people in industry, wherever that comes from. And so let them do it. Why are we standing in the way of financing all this stuff? Like, let's just reduce emissions as quickly as possible and put aside the emotions of which industry or which project we shut down.
I completely agree with that. So how do you do that? I would argue that you don't do that by switching coal to natural gas because of the way the natural gas is extracted. I mean, conventional natural gas is one thing, but we're not really talking about conventional natural gas. We're talking about unconventional natural gas that is A, not as economic, and B, it does have the fugitive emission problem. And it is a big problem, and you're absolutely right. The numbers are different depending on how deep they are, how you're measuring, whether you're doing bottom-up or top-down estimates. It's all over the bloody map, which is why we do need some kind of international standard that is accepted by all, because otherwise we get into this numbers game. I completely agree. I mean, here's an example. One of the biggest emitters in BC is Rio Tinto Alcan Smelter on the coast. They've done some incredible work to reduce their emissions, but they still use the catalyst, the metallurgical coal in the smelting process. So they're researching new technologies to actually eliminate the need to use the coal even in the smelting process. That's exciting. And so that's where we're going to get the innovative breakthroughs. And the only reason that this research and innovation is happening is because there is a price on emissions and because of the regulatory framework that's been put in place in BC and now nationally, which converts to a price too. So now it's getting expensive for companies not to deal with their emissions. So they're starting to invest in the R&D to eliminate them, because it's way better to eliminate than to just do a little bit less.
So Andrew, this has been a fascinating conversation. We're unfortunately getting close to the end of our time here. I think we've highlighted a number of things. And I think that point that you were just talking about with Peter about the fact we need to get the numbers better is really important in the context of Canada making these five-year plans for reductions by every sector, mm-hmm. is that we get that baseline in place, which is going to be quite a lot of work. But the last question I want to ask you is around demand. You know, sometimes it's frustrating for me because we spend a lot of time thinking about how to cut off supply, like cut off LNG from Canada, and then we do nothing to kind of stop people from using natural gas. To me, if we could reduce the use of natural gas, then people would stop producing it. It would happen pretty quickly. Do you think that, you know, we're putting enough focus on demand?
No, but I think we're starting to see the turn. And with both the Clean BC and the federal plans, I do see a lot more. There are talks about building code changes, which are important. In BC, it's the passive building is going to be the norm. Talking about no longer using natural gas in the heating or using renewable natural gas, which can be produced from agricultural products. But again, and I also know the reason why, is because the average person doesn't recognize that each and every one of us is part of the problem, and therefore each and every one of us is part of the solution. And instead, the average person typically likes to point to big industry and governments and say, you're the problem, fix it. And more often than not, it is the individual who's the problem, because governments are elected by individuals and industry produces widgets that individuals consume. So it really is up to the individual to send the signal they want to their political leaders, as well as their industry and business leaders, as to what they value, and use their pocketbook to send that signal and to support the transition that needs to happen. And stop just shouting at the clouds and say someone else do something, because we all have to do something.
Well, fantastic. I think we're all pragmatists at this, and we're aligned on figuring out those optimal pathways to getting to the end. At the end of the day, pragmatist and also a cautious optimist, it's been really delightful talking with you.
And you as well.
Yeah, thank you very much.
Thank you.
And thanks to our listeners. If you enjoyed this podcast, please rate us on the app that you listen to and tell someone else about us.
For more ideas and insights, visit arcenergyinstitute.com.